There are some things that never go out of style in art. Look at paintings from any time period, any part of the globe, and you'll see loving portraits of family members, stunning landscapes, sun and moon, fruit and flowers, rivers, lakes, lots of bridges. Something that does not make that list is ladders. But one local artist has made ladders his muse, and a local gallery has taken a risk on that proposition. So today on KCUR Central Standard, we're starting our first Friday show with Kevin McGraw, painter of ladders. He's got a show up in the Crossroads right now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Are you offended by my observation that ladders aren't like one of the great universal motifs in art?
Not at all. I contemplating doing the ladders several years ago, actually approximately two and a half years ago, I was puzzled about it too. I was like, is this crazy or is this going to do what I intend it to do? And the jury's still out.
You know, it is refreshing that you aren't just following predictable kinds of inspiration or what you think will sell, but it does seem pretty random. Why ladders? When you say, like, you're not sure whether it would do what you hoped it would do, what was that?
Well, mainly to uplift others was the idea. And the original ladder that I was inspired by was my daughter Shay's bunk bed ladder. And she's getting bigger, so we were taking the bunk bed down and the ladder was going down. And I just kept looking at it and I thought, I can't get rid of this thing. In fact, it saved my fall down the stairs of the firehouse.
Okay, back up. The firehouse. Not familiar with that, but also, like, how did this ladder save your life?
Well, we live in an old refurbished firehouse in the Crossroads, and it has a very long staircase. And so,
not a pole?
To the second floor. No, that one's in the museum, they tell me, the Kansas City Museum of Firefighters, which is great.
But I hear you can't insure a firehouse with a pole still in it.
I don't know about that, but since the only poles we have are the hand railings that I did not use while I was going down the stairs with Shay's ladder, thankfully I had her ladder to break my fall. I slipped on the way down to the studio and broke the ladder. And so I was, upon repair of that, I was inspired to do ladders.
That must have been a pretty big fall for you to see this as having been like a life-saving thing, that the ladder broke your fall.
Yeah. Yeah, it was odd because I didn't think of it at the time as much as I have during the course of putting the show together.
Was this conscious that that moment had inspired your obsession with ladders?
It wasn't. It wasn't until I repaired the ladder and had it hanging from one of the pipes in the studio, and I just was looking at it and continued to look at it, and then just one night I said, "That's what I got to do. It saved me a little bit." and then I just thought, "Well, how can I help other people?" And I just thought lifting others is something that I've always been a part of my life, or certainly have wanted it to be a part of my life.
So there's something about the ladder. That's pretty literal, that a ladder lifts you up off the ground. Is there something beyond that? I guess I'm just thinking this is a really intense personal experience, and there's something very sentimental, of course, about a ladder on your daughter's bunk bed that it's time to take down, mm-hmm. even if it hasn't broken your fall right. in that way. But there must be something about it that works for you, like visually or structurally.
Sure. It's beautiful. I mean, ladders are really pretty. If you look at some of the older step ladders and, even to the elaborate fireman ladders that are on the backs of those trucks that save people's lives, they're beautiful, and the thought of them is beautiful to me.
Tell me more about the thought of them.
The thought of how they lift people up, but they also can bring you down from a place that is too high for you. I found that intriguing. And I tried to, it's a utilitarian tool. Everyone has one. You probably have one or two or three. I have like seven, you know, all different ones. And then the idea or the thought of making them was intriguing because it hadn't really been done, and I'd done extensive research, and I couldn't really find anyone making ladders. There was a guy I can't remember his name, but in Japan, he had made this this weather balloon and constructed these fireworks and made a ladder out of it and, you know, hoisted it 500 feet in the sky, then lit the fireworks off. And it was like one of the things, it was one of the only things that I had seen in my research that people were actually using ladders as a medium or to paint on.
There is there's something about the like rhythm of the parallel lines in a ladder that I could see being sort of mesmerizing too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's like a climb. It's like our journey, right? So that part was inspiring, and I kept thinking to myself, is this just so easy or so simple that I shouldn't do it? And then the more I got into it, the more I tried to challenge myself in terms of how I applied the paint and what the ladders did. Some of the ladders don't have both uprights.
These are mostly three-dimensional things.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Not like, in case our listeners aren't quite picturing it.
Yeah. Well, you should check out Todd Weiner Gallery. The show's up through December, and it's an interesting installation. Todd was really up for doing something different, and we did something kind of different in terms of how he's done shows in the past. And galleries typically want to make things very pristine and very clean and very organized. And so we did something in the middle of his gallery floor that he had never done before, which I was excited about, and so was he. And I think it enables you to see and walk all the way around the ladders, so they're not just up on a wall or hanging from a nail. So you know, because I've painted every side of them up, down, back, forward, you get to see all of them.
You know, you mentioned the sort of risk that Todd was taking in showing maybe an unconventional show or something like mm-hmm. that. And it seems like something that you would appreciate. You have kind of a history of showing art in spaces that aren't part of the art scene.
Right.
You know, laundromats.
Right. Oh, you did your research. Yeah, it's nice and refreshing to have gallerists take chances with artists and try to help them not only just display what they've envisioned, but to display the vision of what they've envisioned. And I think Todd really nailed that.
What had led you to these kind of unconventional spaces in the past?
When I was coming up as an artist, they didn't care to look at your work. They cared to where they'd seen your work. And if they hadn't seen your work, it was, they just wouldn't tend to spend any time with you. So instead of, you know, so for me, galleries were unreachable. I couldn't get in, you know, kind of like that thing, experience and to get the job, and you don't have experience, so you can't have the job. So,
yeah.
So I just went out on my own, and I had.
You made yourself an internship.
Yeah, yeah, you could say that. But the laundromat thing was fun because laundromats to me just look like a gallery.
What do you mean?
They're all white, typically, and it's just like a white box like a gallery is, and white machines down below. And so all that wasted space up top intrigued me, and I thought, what a perfect place to hang big, colorful paintings.
How has this pursuit of art fit into the rest of your life? Because you have an eclectic resume, not just when it comes to the list of places where you've shown your art, but also, I mean, you ran a popular divey watering hole in Westport, which is sadly not around anymore. But some of our listeners might remember Kenny's Newsroom.
Yeah, yeah, that was a labor of love. That was first going to be supposed to be a real estate thing. You know, I could buy this building. This is great, and then we'll put the bar in there, and it'll pay the note, and I'll run the bar until it gets on its feet, and then I'll go do another building. Well, 12 years in the newsroom was great, but you know, like most things, it was time to move on.
That was a bar with a theme, which our listeners might detect. I mean, just the newsroom idea. Can you explain that?
Yeah, the original idea was explained to me from a lawyer and a writer named Marvin Arth, and he would come into the bar a lot, and he told me the story of how it got its name and how he named it. Most of the reporters from the Star at the time would go there because you could park in the back parking lot and the boss couldn't see your car. So it was a hideout, literally.
And it'd be like, where were you? I was in the newsroom.
Right, right. Exactly. So they weren't lying.
But you do seem to have a love for kind of populist-y things, like ladders. You mentioned that everyone has one. I mean, you're right. I have a ladder, and I am not a person who has a wide range of tools that I keep around for lots of detailed kinds of projects. You know, I mean,
right, right. You've got your hammer, and yeah, you've got your ladder.
Yeah, right.
Maybe so, a tape measure, probably.
Yes, a tape measure. But, I mean, the dive bar, the ladder, the laundromat. Can you talk to me about that?
I don't know. Maybe it's the blue collar in me. I don't know.
Tell me about your background.
Well, the bar came from, that was the first place my dad took me to have a beer.
And Kenny's Newsroom was?
Yeah, yeah. He worked for Schlitz Brewery, and he was the PR guy. And so his job was to go around and make sure everyone was happy and, you know, kind of like they do today. And so one day, you know, I'm one of 12 kids, so, you know, I was on watch duty that day. Mom either couldn't handle it or was having another baby or something. I don't know. But I was with Dad that day, and he took me to Kenny's and set me down at the end of the bar and said, here, drink this beer and don't tell your mom.
How old do you think you were?
I was 10. And then some years later.
Wait, did you like it? I remember my first taste of beer. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, I loved it.
Really?
I did. I think it was. It wasn't. It was probably my first. I don't know if I had an entire beer or not, but
had an advanced palate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there was a sip or two maybe at the house with Dad every once in a while. He'd sneak one while you were rubbing his neck, you know. So that was just the first place where, and then years later, I had met the owner, Jack West, who had owned it at the time, and I said, anytime you want to sell that bar, I'm ready to buy it. And like 5 years later, he called me, and he said, are you still interested? And I said, I am, and he told me how much he wanted, and I said, okay. And then I wasn't checking my bank account to know that I had enough money to even do it, but we ended up making it work. I had a partner that we ended up figuring it out and ran it fairly successful, very successfully for a long time. And then business just sort of tailed off in Midtown, and it was time to move on.
But I am thinking about bars like Kenny's Newsroom and firehouses, which, you know, you've turned a firehouse into your home, and laundromats, which you've turned into galleries. You do seem to have kind of a fondness for places, public places. I mean, I guess a firehouse isn't quite public, but places where people gather, where groups of people are brought together semi-randomly.
Yeah. That's interesting as you say it. It's always been, you know, being one of 12, there was always big parties. There was always big gatherings, aunts and uncles and grandpas and grandmas. And so, yeah, I think I've always had a fondness for being around a lot of people, and I've always seemed to be pretty comfortable in that arena. And I like creating spaces that do that, you know, and events.
So I want to get back to ladders because we don't have tons of time for this conversation. And I want you to tell me about your favorite ladder in your current show.
Oh, it's got to be Flower Bed.
Talk about it.
That's Shay's bunk bed ladder. So it's, sorry, I'm getting a little emotional. it's just one of those things that you look at every day, right? You wake her up every morning and then you see the same ladder and then it comes down and then you break it on your way down the steps and then you fix it. And then painting the flowers on that one, I have to confess was inspired by Sally Houston. She was, secretary for many, many years at St. Peter's, where Shay attends school and is an eighth grader. But Sally was always took care of me. I'd forget to bring Shay something or other, and she'd always make sure it was okay and made me feel okay that I was being a bad parent or forgetful. And when she passed, I just was blown away at how much love she gave to that school and to those parents and to those kids. And so that's where the flowers were inspired by, was by Sally.
So the ladder became a canvas for those flowers and like a memorial kind of?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was going to donate to the school and for the auction, and we figured out another way to help.
Well, Kevin McGraw, this has been really interesting. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Kevin's show is called Uplift, and you can catch it at the Todd Weiner Gallery through the end of the year. Up next, a local sci-fi book to curl up with under a blanket on a cold, dark night. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And the first Friday of every month, we do an arts show to get excited about the month to come. And since we are entering the wintry season when it is really tempting to just stay home, we figured we'd offer a little something to those of you who want to do that. A good book to hunker down with. A sci-fi read by a local writer caught our interest. It's set in the aftermath of the Second Civil War in the United States, which sets off a period of terrible instability. But finally, the world has come back together and is enjoying an unprecedented scientific renaissance. And that's good because there are a lot of problems that science might very urgently need to solve. Author Christine Schuck, thanks for joining us to talk about your book.
Hi.
So what is this book called? Because I am intimidated to pronounce it.
I have to laugh about that because I thought about it later going, oh, this is kind of hard to pronounce. It's pronounced Gliese. Gliese.
That's not what I would have guessed, but that's okay. So Gliese 581, The Departure?
That's correct, yeah.
Why is it called that?
It's after the planet that Steve Voigt, astronomer, announced finding in 2010. It's the Gliese 581G, and almost as quickly as he announced, hey, we think it's here, others came forward and said, we can't reproduce the results, so it might not be there. But I've actually talked with Mr. Voigt, and they basically said that they couldn't reproduce the results, but he could. So he says, it's still there. So it might actually be a planet about 21 light years away.
And so in the plot of this book, which is actually made up of really little vignettes, but the overarching plot of this book, our main characters are scientists on a mission to a new planet.
Correct.
This planet.
Correct.
Where they hope humans might be able to start a new civilization, because even though the political instability has been resolved, the planet itself has gotten totally messed up.
Right.
And they're going to check it out, but while they're gone...
Just a few months after they leave, a bioengineering company, sort of like one that we know so, so well, I call it Econo, they release a virus into pigs that makes the leap into humans with rather disastrous results.
So I mentioned that there are lots of little vignettes in this book, different storylines all set within this universe. Can you take me to the moment in your life that inspired the very first storyline you thought of?
Sure. It was actually about 20 years ago. And I'm going to tell this story and then everybody's going to go, man, she's got a dark, dark mind. But I was sitting in line at Wendy's drive-thru. And I sat there and I thought, huh, I wonder what it'd be like if a woman drove up completely stark naked to the front, to the window, ordered 10 meals, and proceeded to park her car and eat them until her stomach exploded. And that's the kind of thing I think about right before I eat lunch, apparently. And there it sat, and I just really didn't know where it was going, as so many of my, as I call them, snippets are. They just sit there until
I mean, by snippets, do you mean flashes of what ifs?
Right. What ifs, a scene, if you will. Sometimes it'll be a scene. I'll write it down and then I'll go, well, where's it going? I don't know.
But so where did this one go?
Well, it sat there for a while until I thought, oh, well, look, there's this planet. And, oh, I've always wanted to write a story about a planet. I've practically teethed on sci-fi. This could work. I want to write a story about this group of scientists going to this planet. And, well, what's so special about that? Oh, wait, there'll be a saboteur on board. Well, why? I don't know. And then it took me a little bit of questioning and answering to get it together and go, oh, that's what I'll do. I'll combine these two stories, what I originally called The Plague Tales.
Okay, so what's The Plague Tales? Because it's still not totally clear what 10 Wendy's meals have to do with this storyline about embarking for another planet to save civilization.
Right? They're two separate stories, and yet they are so interconnected. It's kind of... it's part kind of commentary on how far do we take genetic engineering.
But so what is the story that comes out of this thought about eating until your stomach explodes?
I wanted to create this virus that just was so deadly and yet had this really long incubation period so that it would have the maximum effect of spreading. And I actually talked to a virologist and said, give me a virus that will do this. And he said, pseudorabies. I said, pseudorabies? I've never heard of this. And I said, hey, can you add on there somewhere about, you know, infertility, like lots of infertility? You know, so it's really hard for the survivors to have babies. He goes, oh, yeah, herpes virus. I go, that's perfect. So connecting those two and saying, hey, this company comes up with this, I'm going to grow pigs really fast, but I'm going to corner the market by making them infertile. But when it leaps over to humans, suddenly you've got something you did not expect.
All right. So you've talked about a lot of conversations with scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, as a person who started having this idea in the drive-through line, think that you needed scientists to help you tell the stories that came out of your own imagination with more credibility? Or
yes.
Couldn't science fiction get away with ignoring science fact? Is that not possible?
There is always a certain amount of credibility you can, you know, withhold, you know, and then you can make a leap, but you can't make too many leaps. So I have warp technology, the idea of this spaceship getting to a planet 21 light years away in 6 years. That's a big leap. Then I'm saying, I'm going to have this virus that's super, super contagious and deadly. 99.6% deadly. How do I make this realistic? Because you want someone to stay in the story. You want someone to enjoy the story. And if they go, well, you know, unicorns, what the heck does that have to do anything? All of a sudden you've popped them out of the story. And
so we can have time travel.
Well, not time travel, but space travel.
Sorry, space travel.
Yes.
There can be things that seem to us now slightly out of reach, but not unbelievable.
Right. But not too many of them. You can't suspend disbelief for too many things. Otherwise, it becomes distracting. And I want people to read this and go, this could happen.
So for you, I mean, you said you practically teethed on science fiction. Was that because there was a science fiction lover in raising you?
Yes, my father. He gave me all the adolescent science fiction stories by Robert Heinlein. So Pod Cane of Mars is my favorite. But, you know, the Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which isn't adolescent sci-fi, but Red Planet, you know, Space Cadet, so many of those. The Star Beast.
So what was it that initially drew you into the way that science fiction thinks, I guess?
I don't know if it's necessarily science fiction. It goes beyond that. It goes beyond genre. In the end, a story, a really good one, is about relating, the reader relating on a human basic level to another, to this character in the book. And how do we react to adversity? How do we react to really awful things happening in our lives? How do we react to everything being taken away from us?
Is there a character in this book who just really intrigues you in that sense, even though you created these characters?
I think all characters are parts of us. They're the good parts and the bad parts, the parts we hide and the parts that we show. And there's a little bit of all of those in there. I find, if you will, snippets of myself in all of the people I write. the good and the bad.
What part of yourself is Daniel, the sort of main scientist?
Daniel is curious. I don't know that so much of myself is in him as in, I am very curious. He's very conflicted. He's conflicted in relationships and coming to a relationship and going, I need to commit, even in the face of losing everyone he loved. And a lot of guilt. I think that's probably where I recognize myself is dealing with guilt. We all deal with it, you know, and thinking we can't do something when we can.
So we got a little bit off track, but I was starting to ask you about how you as a non-scientist started pursuing scientific knowledge to write this book and to, I don't know, to develop the stories that had come from inside your brain, but you needed the scaffolding of science to tell them. How did you start doing that?
First of all, I am so non-sciencey, I have to admit that. And so that was a huge slowdown on writing this book. Oh, how do I do this? I'm not a scientist. How can I make this real? And all I can say is Facebook. I'm friends with one of my high school teachers and my high school principal as well. And so I went out there and I said, does anybody know a virologist? And pretty soon my teacher from high school said, my brother is a virologist and he's a professor at Washington State University and he'll be happy to talk to you. And thank goodness for him. And again, Facebook, when I said, nurse friends, I have a medical situation. Can you advise? And they, you
like
know,
a fictional medical situation.
Yes, a stabbing. What would this look like? You know, stabbing of an adolescent male and, you know, give me the lingo. And I had a friend of mine was kind enough to do that. So
you just reached out to the people you knew until they could connect you with the people who had the knowledge.
That and a lot of Google searches and reading. I read a great book, Working Stiff by Judy Melinek. She was a medical examiner in 9/11, in the aftermath of 9/11, and I got a really good idea of how autopsies were done there, which was fascinating. I had tried to reach a forensic pathologist or a medical examiner, and they just weren't they didn't have time for me, so I had to read all about it.
Were there things that you learned that ended up not just becoming details in the plot lines you had already created, but ended up inspiring twists within the story?
I'm trying to think. I'm sure there were. Nothing comes to mind at the moment.
I wonder for you, just the whole premise of this book is that part of what happens when the world achieves peace mm-hmm. is that there's a scientific renaissance, which sounds like a very optimistic way of thinking about science.
It probably
thinking
is.
About yeah. Just the creativity and pursuit of knowledge that people can get together and do if they're not distracted by conflict right. or something like that. But then also this book has a lot of really dystopian ideas about what happens as a result of science.
Uh-huh. My husband constantly tells me, well, I'll read him something and he'll say, another Christine special, and everybody dies, and horribly. I don't know why my writing goes to such dystopian things, because I'm actually an optimist, or a realistic optimist. I think, though, that we seek knowledge, we should, and when we're not busy fighting each other, amazing things can happen, amazing things we can learn in the process. And I consider myself an autodidact, which is a self-learner. So I'm doing that all the time. That's my job, in a sense, as a human being, to learn. And so it makes sense to me that if we're not busy, you know, at war and trying to survive, then yes, we should be studying and learning and creating new things.
What do you think? I mean, there's this. You have quotes at the beginning of beginnings of your chapters, and the quote at the beginning of chapter two is, "As our own species is in the process of proving, one cannot have superior science and inferior morals. The combination is unstable and self-destroying."
Mm-hmm.
What does that quote mean to you? Because that seems sort of like the crux of this whole thing.
It is a double-edged sword, isn't it? You know, that in science and in technology, we learn and we grow and we cross new boundaries. And yet, at the same time, then we have to catch up to it. I was listening the other day to some case that's going on where a man was caught having repeatedly burglarized, and they did it by tracking his cell phone. And so the question is that an invasion of privacy? And more importantly, you know, do we go ahead with that? You know, do we go ahead and say, yeah, now we're going to follow you through your cell phone? And where do we stop? And so many of these questions continue as our evolution as a species, well, more our learning and our technological and medical advances continue at such an alarming rate. I'm not saying it's bad, but we walk the knife's edge.
Can you talk about how Kansas City makes its way into GLIZA 581, the departure?
Well, I did set patient zero at a Wendy's. Oh, I called it something different, I believe. But
patient zero with this virus. What are the effects of the virus?
You have for 35 days, it's in the incubation period, you have a slightly elevated temperature. So maybe 0.2, 0.4, you know, nothing particular. An elevated hunger and an elevated appetite, so you don't think you're sick. You might be a little warm, but you don't feel sick. When it turns on day 35, you can't stop eating. And if food's not around, well, other things will do.
Yikes. And this was the story you were getting at when you were saying you were inspired by this random thought about what if a person came to Wendy's and sat and ate 10 meals until their stomach exploded.
Right. When you say it like that, it just sounds so awful.
Well, but so talk to me more, though, about Kansas City and how Kansas City works as part of this fictional, not just world, but universe.
Well, for one, it's my home. And Kansas City has always been home, no matter where I went. So it made sense to center it here because I like Kansas City. Not that I necessarily want to kill off all the inhabitants or anything. That's not the point. It was easy in terms of visual reference to know, hey, you know, they're going to take a drive. And all of my stories end up in Missouri and in Kansas City, other places as well, but their home is here.
Do you think that Kansas City makes an interesting setting for this kind of scene?
I suppose if I lived in Chicago, I would think that Chicago made an interesting scene. But yes, you know, I've always thought Kansas City is rather unique.
What about it? What about Kansas City?
The people. I live in historic Northeast, and I love living where I live. I live in an 1899 Victorian, and I love the neighborhood, and I love the history that we have here. So just probably it goes back to architecture there, and a lot of my characters end up living in my house.
Is that creepy for you? Because terrible things are happening to them.
Well, not when I'm around.
In 2098.
Yeah. It kind of be suck to live at that point, yes.
What do you hope readers take from this journey that you're taking them on?
All of my stories are set within the Capilaran universe, which is Filipino for fate. And all of my stories are an examination, again, of how we deal with adversity. At the bottom level, despite all the death, there is a nice line of hope, if you will, a thread of, you know, that we can survive anything that comes our way as a species, maybe not individually, but as a species. Individually, we fight for that right. And that might be just, you know, way too off base for a sci-fi story, but that is the way I think, that in the end, I have this great deal of faith in the human race that we can be so much. And that's part of what the story is about.
Christine Shuck, author of Gliese 581, The Departure, thanks for helping us get ready for some cold nights.
Absolutely, Gina. Thank you.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll have an idea for those of you who want to go out but also want to stay in cozy pajamas. And hey, man, I can relate. That's coming right up in just a minute. This is a song by The Architects. Maybe we were faded. As you can hear, they play loud, danceable rock music. Nothing sleepy, but the band's got an upcoming gig at a pajama party. A pajama dance party in a museum later this month. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we'll hear from a band member about the music, and then we'll talk to a museum staffer about this whole pajama situation. For now, drummer Adam Phillips, good morning.
Good morning.
So tell me about The Architects. How would you describe the sound?
It's fun, loud rock and roll music.
The band is part of a little family of bands that I guess you could say ignited kind of like a Kansas City, Lawrence indie movement. Movement might be a dramatic way of putting it, but maybe
a little,
not.
Well, you know, it's hard to speak about any influence we've had, but my brothers and I, Zach and Brandon, we've been playing together since I was 10 years old, and we've just always been playing music together. It's,
So The Architects, that band started in what, 2002?
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And the other bands in that constellation, in case people recognize these names, like The Anniversary, the Gadgets, the Get Up Kids.
We've been playing shows with those guys since we were all kids. We were the Gadgets until around 2002. And we had done shows with, you know, the Get Up Kids and the Anniversary. And those bands kind of blew up and made a whole lot of stuff happen. And we were just kind of in a different scene from them for a long time. But we've just been cranking out records and touring. And
you've got a new band, The Radar State?
Yes. Radar State is, so that's Matt and Jim from the Get Up Kids and Josh Berwanger from the Anniversary and me. And we just started playing together about, I don't know, 6-8 months ago. And it's just been super fun. It just happened really fast. Josh called me up and asked if I'd want to do that band, and how do you say no to something like that? It just sounds like too much fun. So
we're hearing some of that sound right now, and this is a song called Spinning Wheel. How is the sound of Radar State? Is it different, or is it same idea, different grouping of people?
Well, yeah, the idea with Radar State was just that we all just wanted another outlet, you know, to play the fun music that we grew up listening to, which is a lot of like the fun pop, you know, pop punk stuff.
So fun is an important part of this for you, of music.
Oh yeah. 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 Fun's a big part of it. It in addition to just it being fun, which might be the
like fun
most
to perform.
Important. Yeah. Fun to perform, fun to listen to, fills us with memories about how fun it was to discover this kind of music.
And a lot of people like to claim some sort of like lofty philosophical drive, and I really like that you're just embracing the fun.
Mostly it has to do with it being fun. there is definitely a political bent to it. It happened right as the election was coming to a close, and we got stuck with Trump. And all the punk rock that we grew up with was a lot of this very political stuff. The Dead Kennedys, the Stiff Little Fingers, the Specials, they're all, you know, ranting about, you know, Margaret Thatcher or Reagan or these things that we were either not born yet or we were tiny children when that stuff was happening. So we knew we loved that music and what it was talking about, but we didn't relate to it in quite the same way until the doom, you know, really struck us when Trump won the election. And then it felt right to churn out some political punk rock.
So that was the Radar State, but it's with the Architects that you'll be performing for a pajama jam.
Yes.
Do you feel like this music is pajama dance party material?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, even punk rockers like to dance and wear pajamas.
Okay, I'm going to turn now to Kat Mueller from the Nelson about this pajama business. Kat, I want you to know I'm totally on board with going out in pajamas. I think about it a lot when I put a toddler in footed pajamas and think, this is awesome. But where did this whole idea come from?
So my colleague Krishan and I, you know, we come up with different themes and stuff for Third Thursday. And just thinking about
Thursday, that's like a kind of a young adult night.
Exactly. Party. It's our, you know, quote unquote late night, 6 to 9 p.m., which is late for a museum. And this kind of thing happens in museums around the country. Where
pajama dance parties?
Not pajama dance parties. I think we're pretty unique with that. But the late night kind of fun that tries to invite, like, young people, like, you know, 21 to 40s, like, kind of age group into the museum to have a night of fun. Usually there's happy hours involved and things like that. We're no different, but we are inviting people to come to the museum in their pajamas, and it kind of arose out of this whole, like, you know, it's the holidays and people are dressing up in their sequins and their party dresses and going out, and I like being really cozy in my pajamas, and I'm part of the demographic that we're looking for, so I can't be the only one. So I figured, you know, we did a pajama jam once before, and I thought if I can't be the only one who would be interested in just going out super cozy, not have to dress up, and just kind of run and have fun with it. And people did. So we're
bringing
it back.
Did people come in what you think they usually really wear to bed, or did people do the dressing up version of wearing pajamas?
I think it's the dressing up version, like, version of pajamas.
Tell me about some of the styles you witnessed.
Yes. Okay. And you can always look at these photos yourself on our Flickr account from our last pajama jam. But there was a onesie fleece Winnie the Pooh pajama outfit and a Tigger. They were not in the same group though. But, like, you know, you start to draw connections.
Destined to meet.
I think so too. I myself wore my Batman fleece onesie. With like
you,
a little.
Did you
hood.
Already have that?
I did.
Wow.
I detect a note of judgment in that, but I swear.
No.
It was so comfortable.
No, that's not what that is. I'm like, you're my hero right now.
You know, so a lot of like really fun onesies like that, you know, that you see out and about. Some people did wear some ugly Christmas sweater kind of things, or like, you know, like the Nordic print, like with the snowflakes and reindeers and stuff. But then, you know, a different twist on it, like a Batman logo or Superman logo in that as well. A lot of superhero kind of dressing up for pajamas, a lot of cartoon characters. And,
but did you?
Yeah.
Okay. So did the kind of fun that you had at this event, did it feel different to you because you were in pajamas and everyone else was? Like, did people behave differently in pajamas?
I don't think so. Not compared to the other Third Thursdays. I feel Third Thursday is just such a fun It's like a fun event where you can come by yourself. I've seen people come on their own and then start to like meet people or like with a group of friends, and everyone's just laughing and having a good time. Super open to everybody. Like I'll go around and talk to people, make sure like, hey, how's everything going? Have you been here before? And people are just super open to the experience, like whatever that theme is. And I think Pajama Jam is no different.
So Adam, will you be in pajamas? Had you thought about this?
The jury's out on that one. I don't know yet.
Oh, you could do it.
I should do something. Maybe I should have a robe or something. But performing,
drumming
is a different sort of a deal than just hanging out and trying mm-hmm. to dance. So I might have to do like a costume change, you know,
for when you're dancing.
From when I'm hanging out to when I'm performing. I don't know. I really haven't put a lot of thought into this yet.
Have some fuzzy slippers on the side.
Yeah, I could do that.
So have you, in your experience performing as a musician, have you performed in settings where people are like, where there's kind of a theme and does that affect you as a musician?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, when I was a kid and we were doing a lot of our first tours, we were a ska band. So yeah, kind of every night was a bit of role playing, you know, cosplay stuff. Everybody's, you know, trying to dress up, you know, in one to look like one faction of people or another, the Rude Boys or the, you know, Civil War reenactor punk rockers or the, you know, so I'm not afraid of that. That sounds fun to me. I don't know. I'm sure that there is some photographic evidence that I've been guilty of, some of that same role playing, but nothing comes to mind right away.
So Christine, okay, what is your biggest hope for, what is the best possible scenario for you? A bunch of grown people put on their best pajamas and head to the art museum for a dance party. Talk to me about just your dreams, your hopes?
My hopes and dreams and aspirations?
Yes.
For this particular pajama jam?
Yes.
So I want to see people come out having fun in their best pajamas. You know, we had to note, you know, you have to wear a shirt, you have to wear pants, you have to wear shoes.
It's pretty restrictive.
I figured, you know, if someone took Pajama Jam literally and came in their normal, quote unquote, pajamas, that might not work out so well. So we had to stipulate that.
So traction on footed pajamas does not count as shoes.
I did not think of that question. I guess if there's foot coverings, you're not walking through the museum barefoot, I think that's fine, whether that's part of footy pajamas or not. That's an excellent question. And okay. I think the social media coordinator who helps us out with Third Thursday will keep that in mind as well for any future questions.
Sorry, your hopes and dreams.
Hopes and dreams for this is I want a bunch of people just coming together, having a lot of fun, rocking out to the Architects in their pajamas, being really open to this fun, kind of irreverent, casual experience in the museum, because that's kind of what Third Thursday is about. You know, it's meeting people on multiple kinds of levels. You know, sometimes we have like self-guided gallery tours, right? So if you're not comfortable going through the whole museum by yourself on a formal tour, you can kind of like pick and choose a couple galleries, and maybe you'll start getting comfortable. So that's one big part of it. And then if we can just have people coming and enjoying the museum in different ways, that's what I'm happy about.
Well, cool. Our time is up, as you can hear, but Kat Mueller with us from the Nelson, thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Adam Phillips, thank you.
Thank you.
You can hear Adam's band, one of Adam's bands, The Architects, at the Nelson's Third Thursday Pajama Jam on December 21st. And that's a wrap for our December arts show. But check out lots of other artsy stuff from our week at kcur.org/centralstandard. We spoke with Rodolfo Marone III about his new exhibit, and a filmmaker talked to us about a new documentary she made about her grandmother who survived the Holocaust. If you missed those shows, listen back at kcur.org/centralstandard. And it's the weekend. but you can still talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs, and Linda Scher runs the board for us every day and makes us sound awesome. Up to Date is next. Have a great weekend.